Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like all book lovers, is incredibly saddened by the recent passing of Tom Clancy. Clancy burst into our literary consciousness with his debut, The Hunt for Red October, often cited as one of the greatest genre novels ever written. When it hit the bookshelves in 1984, it was hailed as a new kind of potboiler, an espionage thriller dense with technical details about weaponry, submarines, and intelligence agencies. Clancy was born into a middle-class Baltimore family on April 12, 1947. In his youth, he skipped over Kid Lit to read naval history, often choosing journals and books intended for military officers and engineering experts. He attended Loyola College in Baltimore, majoring in English. Wanting to serve in the military, Clancy was told he was too nearsighted. He began working at a small insurance agency founded by his wife's grandfather in rural Maryland, work he was happy to abandon after he became a successful writer. Clancy first submitted The Hunt for Red October to the Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, Maryland. There, editor Deborah Grosner found it mesmerizing, but she had a hard time persuading her boss to read it. Clancy was an unknown, and the publisher had no experience with fiction. She was also concerned the novel had too many technical descriptions and asked Clancy to make cuts. He complied, trimming at least 100 pages while making revisions. The press paid him $5,000 for the book. And you know the rest of the story. The incredible popularity of Clancy's work made him into a millionaire many times over. He even became part owner of the Baltimore Orioles. More than 100 million copies of Clancy's novels are in print, 17 making it to the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list, including Threat Vector, released last December, which we'll preview today. Clancy's newest title, Command Authority, will be released on December 3rd. And a movie prequel about Jack Ryan's pre-CIA days, Jack Ryan, will be in theaters this Christmas with Chris Pine in the title role. The spy PI thriller genre will carry on, and of course, it is incredibly rich. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with Nelson DeMille, another master of the genre. But in spirit and in memoriam, the book report dedicates this show to Clancy and the genre he and all of us love. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. Clancy's Threat Vector, book 15 in the Jack Ryan series, Ryan has only just moved back into the Oval Office when he is faced with a new international threat. An aborted coup in the People's Republic of China has left President Wei Jianlin with no choice but to support the expansionist policies of the army. Will China invade Taiwan? The Ryan administration is determined to thwart China's ambitions, but the stakes are high as a new breed of powerful Chinese anti-ship missiles endanger the U.S. Navy's plans to protect the island. Meanwhile, Chinese cyber warfare experts have launched a devastating attack on American infrastructure. Jack Ryan Jr. and his colleagues at the campus may be the wild card his father needs to stack the deck. Lou Diamond Phillips performs the book.
Though they all were still as stones now, they had been a blur of activity over the past week. They had surveilled targets, developed op plans, established covers, memorized their primary, secondary, and tertiary exfiltration routes, and coordinated the logistics of the mission to come. But preparations were now complete, and there was nothing left to do but sit and wait for darkness. A rumble of thunder rolled in from the south. A lightning strike far out in the Sea of Marmara illuminated the five statues in the room for an instant, and then the darkness covered them once again. This hotel was situated in the Sultanahmet district of Istanbul, and it was chosen as the team's safe house due to the courtyard parking for their vehicles and the fact that it was more or less equidistant to where the operations would be carried out later in the evening. The hotel was not, however, chosen for the vinyl bedspreads, or the grimy hallways, or the surly staff, or the stench of pot smoke that wafted up from the youth hostel on the ground floor. But the Americans did not complain about their accommodations. They thought only of their tasks ahead. At 7 p.m., the leader of the cell looked down to the chronograph on his wrist. It was fastened over bandaging that covered his entire hand and a portion of his forearm. As he stood up from a wooden chair, he said, We'll head out one at a time, 5 minutes separation. The others, two seated on a bed speckled with rat shit, one leaning against the wall by the door, and one more standing by the window, all nodded. The leader continued. I sure as hell do not like splitting up the op like this. This is not how we do business, but frankly, circumstances dictate our actions. If we don't do these mutts damn near simultaneously, word will get out and the roaches will scatter in the light. The others listened without responding. They'd been over this a dozen times in the past week. They knew the difficulties, they knew the risks, and they knew their leader's reservations. Their leader's name was John Clark. He'd been doing this sort of thing since before the youngest of the men on his team had been born, so his words carried weight. I've said it before, gentlemen, but indulge me one more time. No points for style on this one. He paused. In and out. Quick and cold. No hesitation. No mercy. They all nodded again. Clark finished his speech and then slipped a blue raincoat over his three-piece pinstripe suit. He stepped over to the window and reached out with his left hand, shaking the offered left hand of Domingo Ding Chavez. Ding was dressed in a three-quarter-length leather coat and a heavy watch cap. A canvas bag lay at his feet. Ding saw perspiration on his mentor's face. He knew Clark had to be in pain, but he'd not complained all week. Chavez asked, "You up for this, John?" Clark nodded. "I'll get it done." John then reached a hand out to Sam Driscoll, who stood up from the bed. Sam was dressed in a denim jacket and jeans, but he also wore knee and elbow pads and, on the bed next to where he'd been sitting, a black motorcycle crash helmet lay on its side. "Mr. C," Sam said. John asked, "You ready for the fly swat?" "About as ready as I'm going to get." "It's all about the angle. Get the angle right, commit to it, and let momentum do the rest." Sam just nodded as another flash of lightning lit up the room. John stepped over to Jack Ryan Jr. Jack was in head-to-toe black, cotton pants, a pullover knit sweater, and a knit mask rolled up above his face so it looked like a watch cap, similar to the one worn by Chavez. He also wore soft-soled shoes that looked like black slippers. With a handshake, Clark said, "Good luck, Junior," to the 27-year-old Ryan. "I'll be fine." "I know you will." Last, John walked around the bed, and here he shook the left hand of Dominic Caruso. Dom wore a red and gold soccer jersey and a bright gold scarf, upon which the word Galatasaray was emblazoned in red. His attire stood out from the muted colors around the room, but his countenance was much less bright than his dress. With a severe expression, Dom said, "Brian was my brother, John. I don't need..." Clark interrupted. "Have we talked about this?" "Yes, but..." "Son, whatever our five targets are up to here in Turkey, this op has gone way past simple revenge for your brother. Still, we are all Brian's brothers today. We are all in this together." "Right, but I want your mind on your job, nothing else. Every one of us knows what we are doing. These JSO assholes have committed other crimes against their own people and against the U.S., and it's clear from their present movements that they are up to no good. Nobody else is going to stop them."
We've just heard Threat Vector by Tom Clancy and Mark Greeny. Nelson DeMille is one of today's most popular thriller writers. Born in the Big Apple, he graduated from Hofstra University. He served as a first lieutenant in the U.S. Army from 66 to 69 and saw action as an infantry platoon leader with the 1st Cavalry Division in Vietnam. Nelson was decorated with the Air Medal, Bronze Star, and the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. I'm sure you're familiar with many of DeMille's titles: The Gold Coast, The General's Daughter, Plum Island, The Lion's Game, Nightfall, The Lion and the Panther. And I'm sure, like me, his character, John Corey, is one of your favorites. Today we'll speak with him about The Quest. It's quite the page-turner. Let's see if we can get the inside scoop. Welcome, Nelson. It's a thrill to have you with us on The Book Report.
Thank you, Elaine.
I want to start by saying The Charm School is one of my all-time favorite books. My first cousin was a U.S. Air Force pilot in Vietnam. His plane was shot down, and he remains an MIA. And when I read The Charm School, it knocked me down.
Yeah, it's based on some theory. The Charm School is about what happened to over 1,000 American pilots were shot down over North Vietnam or Laos, and in the Chomsky, they postulate that they wound up in Russia to train Russian spies to look, act, and talk like Americans. And that was something I'd heard when I was in Vietnam myself in 68. And there's actually a show on cable TV now called The Americans, which is kind of the same thing, about training Russians to infiltrate American society and to become Americans, but really to become fifth columnists. So it's a fascinating, I think, subject. And sorry about your cousin, too, by the way.
Well, thank you. All right, let's talk about The Quest. It's a rewrite of an earlier book, one you wrote nearly 40 years ago. Why revisit the subject matter now?
That's a good question. The Quest is about a search for the Holy Grail. It takes place in the jungles of Ethiopia. And the story itself is timeless, obviously timeless, because we've been telling it for about 2,000 years now, and I'm not the first one to interpret it. You have everything from King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table to Monty Python and the Holy Grail and everything in between, including Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code and that type of thing. So, and also Indiana Jones. In fact, I call the book Indiana Jones Meets the Da Vinci Code. So it's kind of it in a nutshell. And it was really a good story. And when I wrote it in 1974, published in 75, I didn't have many fans. I think I had maybe a few dozen fans out there. And the book appeared as an original paperback, and it was never a hardcover. So, you know, with the passage of almost 40 years, I thought that this was a good story that really deserved a new audience and deserved different formats, not only hardcover, but e-books and audio. And the publisher agreed, and so they said, go ahead and try this. And it's kind of odd, or I shouldn't say odd, but rare for best-selling novels to go back to a much, much earlier work. And this may start a trend, hopefully, because there's a lot of good stuff out there that could use a rewrite. And it was a challenge, but I'm glad I did it. And I think the story is fresh. And now it's available for hopefully a much larger audience.
Right. Talk about how you research your books. I mean, this book is set in Ethiopia in 1974. You write of the brutal fighting, the Amhara, the Galas. So do you get all the history down? Do you visit the country?
Yeah, you know, when I was writing the book, these events are actually happening in 1974, 75. A lot of the research was just done with the newspapers and some TV coverage of what was going on in Ethiopia. I'd never done that before, but I think that maybe that's what compelled me into writing the book, because it was an interesting revolution. It was a Marxist revolution that toppled the Emperor Haile Selassie, who was a very heroic figure, and how Haile Selassie traced his ancestors back to the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. It was a 3,000-year-old dynasty that was coming to an end, and at the same time, of course, there was this myth that the Holy Grail and the Ark of the Covenant were in Ethiopia. So I kind of combined this, and I was a history major, so I understood the history part easily enough. And I, like a lot of kids, I grew up with King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table. So it was a fun story to write. When I put it all together, and I came up with another version of The Search for the Holy Grail, and it got good reviews. But again, it didn't have a lot of play back in 1974. So when I rewrote it, I saw that the research held up pretty well. There wasn't much I had to do. It had a good feel for the time and place. And mostly I worked on the characterizations and worked on cleaning up some of my bad syntax.
Speaking of characters, I just want to do an aside here. And where did you get the inspiration for John Corey? Is he based any part on you, your humor, your dashing good looks?
You're very kind, Lloyd. Right. We have met in the city in New York City before. Well, I don't know. Now that you've met me, no, I am not John Corey. John Corey is taller than me, for one thing. But John Corey is NYPD, retired now, working for the Joint Terrorist Task Force. And he's really a composite of a lot of police today. Now, I know people in the Joint Terrorist Task Force, and they've been very kind to me and giving me info and letting me visit the headquarters at 26 Federal Plaza in New York City. And John Corey, of course, being a cop and working with the FBI, who are very straight and very proper, and he's sort of a cowboy, so it's kind of an amusing situation. But I got my start in the 70s when I was, before I even wrote The Quest, writing NYPD police procedurals, because I had relatives in the New York City Police Department. So I kind of understood the character, and probably I hang around too many bars where the cops hang around, and district attorneys here where I am on Long Island. I'm close to the county seat in the courthouse, so these are some of my haunts. I understood that world without having been a cop myself. And I created this guy, and he's a man's man, but the women like him too. I think maybe you'll agree, I hope.
Absolutely. And you know, a lot of my fellow thriller lovers think that, for example, The Panther is one of the funniest thrillers I've ever read. So some of my colleagues want to know if you were always a wise guy.
Well, you know, my earlier books, even the bestsellers, didn't have a lot of humor. And I instinctively knew something was missing from the books. But, you know, when you write, you're supposed to be serious. But one of my books, The Gold Coast, I decided to give this guy a wry and very sardonic sense of humor. And it really worked. And then when I went to John Corey, NYPD, of course, cops all over the world have a funny sense of humor. And I brought it into the book. And even though the subject matter is serious, the sense of humor is going to come through. It's kind of that dark humor, that gallows humor. When things are going wrong, you kind of make a joke about it.
We're speaking with Nelson DeMille on The Book Report.
And John Corey seems very quick in his repartee, but a writer can freeze time. When you're trying to write dialogue, you can let 5 minutes go by and think about how what his instantaneous response would be. And in real life, we can't do that. In real life, we always say, oh, gosh, I wish I'd said that. And it's too late to say it. But one of the advantages of being a novelist is you can just freeze it right there and think about it. And it sounds like it's a very quick comeback and very quick banter, but in actuality, it's taken me a few minutes to think about it.
So when I was doing the research for this interview, I learned you write your books using pen and paper. Why, and have you ever tried writing on a computer?
Well, I can't type, for one thing, but even if I could type, I don't think I would type the first draft. Certainly would not type the first draft. We all learn how to write with a pencil and paper, and this is how I write. And it's got a better flow. It's just easier. I don't have to deal with the machine. I can, it's, you know, me, my, hopefully my brain is engaged and my hand is engaged. And also, with my other hand, I'm looking at research material, notes that I've made. I enjoy the writing process. I mean, the physical writing process of writing out a whole manuscript longhand. Usually I do two drafts, maybe sometimes three. And then I give it to my assistant to put on, put it to the computer, and then I can play with it on a computer. Sometimes I'm here, you know, late at night writing, and I feel like a monk in a cell illuminating a manuscript. And but it's fun, and I think I'm too old to bother to learn how to compose on a typewriter, so it's okay. I'm going to leave well enough alone.
All right. Well enough is pretty darn good. What's your next project?
Well, the next one is a John Corey novel. I wanted to give John a break, and John Corey is back. We don't have a title yet, but he's back in New York. The last time we saw him with The Panther, he was in Yemen in the war on terrorism. This time he's in New York, but he's not going to be involved with the war on terrorism in this new book, Islamic Terrorism, I should say. The new bad guy is going to be the Russians, partly because of what's happening in the world and what's going on, you know, and Putin's Russia. So John Corey has a very very tough adversary in the new book. He's battling the old KGB, and hopefully that book will be out this time next year.
All right, and are these bad guys going to go around bare-chested, or are they actually going to wear shirts?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because I've done a couple of Cold War thrillers, as you probably know, and I kind of miss the Russians, and I think a lot of writers miss the Cold War and miss the Russians as bad guys, so this should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Nelson, any upcoming film projects?
Yeah, but not feature film. Cable TV has come to me, Sony TV, and they want to take the first John Corey book, which was Plum Island, and make it into what they call a limited series, which is 6 1-hour segments. And they will do Plum Island as 6 1-hour segments, And they have Aaron Eckhart, who's a very good actor, who's going to play the part of John Corey. And if the first one, Plum Island, is successful, they're going to take each of the next five John Corey books and make them a limited series on one of the cable channels.
Hmm. And when can we look out for that?
You know, TV moves very quickly. It could be as early as this fall. Not this fall, but I should say next fall. And it'll be called, probably be called John Corey, Plum Island. We have to come up with the title so we can tie the characters together, the character together with the entire series.
Mm.
And I'm looking forward to working with it because they've asked me to do a little work with them. And I don't normally do screenplays, but I think I would like to do this.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to it, too. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine.
All righty. And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Quest, performed by Scott Brick.
The elderly Italian priest crouched in the corner of his cell and covered himself with his straw pallet. Outside, screaming artillery shells exploded into the soft African earth, and shrapnel splattered off the stone walls of his prison. Now and then, a shell airburst overhead and hot metal shards pierced the corrugated metal roof. The old priest curled into a much tighter ball and drew the pitifully thin pallet closer. The shelling stopped abruptly. The old man relaxed. He called out to his jailers in Italian.
"Why are they bombing us? Who is doing this thing?"
But he received no answer. The older Ethiopians, the ones who spoke Italian, had gradually disappeared over the years, and he heard less and less of his native tongue through the stone walls. In fact, he realized he hadn't heard a word of it in almost 5 years. He shouted in snatches of Amharic, then to Grinya.
"What is it? What is happening?"
But there was no answer. They never answered him. To them, he was more dead than the ripening bodies that lay in the courtyard. When you ask questions for 40 years and no one answers, it can only mean that you are dead. But he knew they dared not answer. One had answered once when he first entered his cell. Was it 40 years now? Perhaps it was less. The years were hard to follow. He could not even remember the man who had answered, except for the skull. His jailers had given him the skull of the one who had answered him. The skull was his cup. He remembered the man and his kindness each time he drank. And the jailers remembered when they filled his cup. They remembered not to speak to him. But he asked anyway. He called out again.
"Why is there war? Will you release me?"
He stared at the iron door on the far wall. It had closed on a young man in 1936, when Ethiopia was an Italian colony, and the door had not opened since. Only the small pass-through at the bottom of the iron door was ever used. His sustenance came in, and his waste went out once a day through that small portal. A window, no larger than a big book, really just a missing stone, above eye level, let in light, sounds, and air. His only possessions in the cell, aside from his tattered shama, was a wash basin, a pair of dull scissors that he used to cut his hair and nails, and a holy Bible written in Italian, which they had let him keep when he was first imprisoned. If it weren't for his Bible, he knew, he would have gone mad many years ago. He had read the holy book perhaps 100, 200 times, and though his eyesight was growing weaker, he knew every word by heart. The Old and New Testaments brought him comfort and escape, and kept his mind from dying, and kept his soul nourished. The old man thought of the young man who walked through the iron door in 1936. He knew every detail of the young man's face and every movement of his body. At night, he spoke to the young man and asked him many things about their native Sicily. and he knew the young man so well that he even knew what went on inside his mind, and how he felt, and where he went to school, and the village he came from, and how old his father was. The young man never got older, of course, and his stories were always the same. But his was the only face the old man knew well enough to remember. He had seen that young face in the mirror for the last time, close to 40 years ago, and not again since, except in his mind's eye. He wept.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Quest, performed by Scott Brick. Buckingham Palace Blues is the third in James Craig's best-selling Inspector Carlyle series. It's a new one for the book report, one I think you'll enjoy. When Inspector John Carlyle discovers a disoriented girl in a park near Buckingham Palace, he takes it upon himself to find out who she is and where she's from. The hunt for her identity takes him from Ukrainian gangsters in North London to the lower reaches of the British aristocracy. Soon the inspector is on the trail of a child trafficking ring that stretches from Kiev to London and back to the palace itself. Joe Jameson narrates.
Joe Dalton took a bite out of his fried egg roll, chewed it a couple of times, and spat it out of the window of the Austin FX4. Despite having eaten little for more than 3 days now, he could feel the bile rising instantly in his throat and knew that no food would stay down. Disgusted, he chucked the rest of the roll into the gutter and wiped his hands on his grubby Nickelback t-shirt. Gingerly taking the cardboard cup from the drinks holder on the dashboard, he removed the lid and blew gently on his oily black coffee. He took a tiny sip and winced. Horrible. Wearily, he opened the cab door and climbed out. Pouring the steaming liquid down a drain leading into one of London's crumbling sewers, he then dropped the cardboard cup and its plastic lid into a nearby bin. Shivering in the cold, he went round to the back of the cab and opened the boot. Coiled on top of the spare wheel inside was the length of cord that he had been carrying around with him for weeks. 3-strand, 6mm white nylon. Excellent shock absorption properties with a guaranteed brake load of 750 kilograms. With a sigh, he pulled it out, knowing that it was more than capable of doing the job required. Sticking it under his arm, Dalton slammed the boot shut and walked towards the streetlight beside which he had parked the taxi. Looping one end of the rope around its metal pole, he tied it securely with a simple overhand knot. Stepping back to the cab, he tossed the rope through the driver's window, opened the door, and got back in. After putting on his seatbelt, he took a couple of deep breaths. Then he wound the free end of the rope round his neck 3 times, tying it off with the same kind of knot. It was tight, but not too tight. The nylon cut into his neck, but he could still breathe. Gritting his teeth, he switched on the ignition and pushed the stick into first gear. Fuck it! Tears welling up in his eyes, he released the handbrake and stomped on the accelerator. Fernando Garros returned his cup of tea to its saucer and idly watched the taxi driver getting in and out of his cab. He recognized the grinning face of Chad Kruger on the guy's shirt and gave a small nod of approval. Nickelback were cool. Fernando had spent more than a day's wages to go and see them at Wembley the year before. The extra £20 for a t-shirt had been beyond him, but at least he had seen an awesome show. He hummed a few bars of Burn It to the Ground before turning around, embarrassed, to check that no one had heard him. He needn't have worried. Sitting by the window, he had Goodfellas Cafe to himself. Apart from the cabbie, there had been no other customers through the door in the last hour. Xavi, the cafe's Spanish owner, had been fast asleep behind the counter for the last 20 minutes. Yawning, Fernando checked his watch. It was almost 3:15 a.m. Closing his eyes, he folded his arms and stretched out his legs. He was in no rush. He had come off an 11-hour shift as a hospital porter at St. Thomas's and was enjoying his dinner, or was it his breakfast, before he made the 15-minute walk back to the bedsit he had rented for the last 8 years. Elephant and Castle wasn't the greatest neighbourhood to be wandering around in at night, but if he waited another half hour or so, he could be reasonably sure that all the gangbangers, nutters and general assholes who might otherwise try to impede his journey home would have gone to bed. Xavi's snoring grew louder. Opening his eyes, Fernando finished the last of his tea and thought about helping himself to another cup. Deciding against it, he returned his gaze to the cabbie who had now returned to the relative warmth of his taxi. Fernando was amused by the way London cab drivers fussed over their taxis. He found it strange. True, the vehicles were expensive, £30,000 or more, he'd read somewhere. But even so, at the end of the day, it was just another car.
Mierda!
Fernando almost fell off his chair as the cab suddenly shot backwards, jumped the pavement, knocked over a rubbish bin, and crashed into the front window of a dry cleaner's. Immediately, several alarms started ringing.
What happened?
Xavi appeared at his shoulder, yawning, and went over to the door.
Car accident.
Fernando then noticed the rope hanging from the lamppost, trailing along the pavement. He was fairly sure that hadn't been there before.
We've just heard Buckingham Palace Blues by James Craig. Seattle investigator J.P. Beaumont investigates a dark, deadly conspiracy that reaches deep into the halls of state government in J.A. Jantz's latest, Betrayal of Trust, book 20 in the series. At first glance, a video appears to be showing a childish game. A teenage girl with dark, wavy hair smiles for the camera, a blue scarf tied around her neck. Suddenly, things turn murderous, and the girl ends up dead. It's as horrifying as a snuff film can get, and worse, the clip has been discovered on a phone belonging to the grandson of Washington State's governor. The troubled boy swears he's never seen the victim before. The governor turns to old friend J.P. Beaumont for help. The Seattle PI has witnessed many horrific acts over the years, but this one ranks near the top. Beaumont discovers that what initially appeared to be a childish prank gone wrong has deep, disastrous implications. J.R. Horn narrates.
Since we were sitting looking out at an expanse of water, it would be easy to think that's the water I meant when I spoke to Mel, but it wasn't. In Seattle, that term refers to several different bodies of water, depending on where you are at the time and where you're going. In this case, we were looking at Elliott Bay, which happens to be our water view, but we work on the other side of Lake Washington. In this instance, the traffic water in question. People who live on Lake Washington or on Lake Sammamish would have an entirely different take on the matter when they use the same two words. Context is everything. Okie dokie, Mel said, hopping off the window seat. Another refill, she asked. I gave her my coffee mug. She took it, went to the kitchen, filled it, and came back. She handed me the cup and gave me a quick kiss in the process. I started a new pot for our traveler, she said, then added, back in a flash. I'd showered and dressed while she was out, not that I needed to. There are two full baths as well as a powder room in our unit. When I married Mel rather than share mine, she took over the guest bath and made it her own, complete with all the mysterious vials of makeup and moisturizers she deems necessary to keep herself presentable. I happen to think Mel is more than presentable without any of that stuff, but I've gathered enough wisdom over the years to realize that my opinion on some subjects is neither requested nor appreciated. So we split the bathrooms. As long as we share the bed in my room, I don't have a problem with that. Occasionally, I find myself wondering about my first marriage to Karen, who is now deceased. Most of the time we were married, we had two bathrooms, one for us and one for the kids. Would our lives have been smoother if Karen and I had been able to have separate bathrooms as well? No, wait. Denial is a wonderful thing, and I'm going to call myself on it. Despite my pretense to the contrary, the warfare that occurred in Karen's and my bathroom usually had nothing to do with the bathroom itself. Karen was a drama queen, and I was a jerk, for starters. Yes, we did battle over changing the toilet paper rolls and leaving the toilet seat up and hanging pantyhose in the shower curtain rod and leaving clots of toothpaste in the single sink. But those were merely symptoms of what was really wrong with our marriage. namely my drinking and my working too much. All the squabbling in our bathroom, the only real private place in the house, was generally about those underlying issues, rather than the ones we claimed we were fighting about. For years, Karen and I never showed up at the kitchen table for breakfast without having spent the better part of an hour railing at each other first. I'm sure those constant verbal battles were very hard on our kids, and I regret them to this day, but I have to tell you that the pleasant calmness that prevails in my life with Mel Soames is nothing short of a dream come true. Don't let the different last names fool you. Mel is my third wife. She didn't take my name, and I didn't take hers. As for the single day Ann Corley's and my marriage lasted, she didn't take my name either. So I'm two for one in the wives keeping their own names department. Karen evidently didn't mind changing names at all. She took mine, and later, when she married Dave Livingston, her second husband, she took his name as well. So much for the high and low points of J.P. Beaumont's checkered romantic past. When the coffee pot, an engineering marvel straight out of Starbucks, beeped quietly to let me know it was done, I went out to the kitchen and poured most of the pot into our two hefty stainless steel traveling mugs. This is Seattle. We don't go anywhere or do anything without sufficient amounts of coffee plugged into the system. I was just tightening the lid on the second one when Mel appeared in the doorway looking blonde and wonderful. Maybe the makeup did make a tiny bit of difference, but I can tell you she's a whole lot better looking than any other homicide cop I ever met.
That was a clip from Betrayal of Trust by J.A. Jantz. A Brit in the FBI is a new series from Catherine Coulter, written with J.T. Ellison. In this story, The Final Cut, Scotland Yard's new chief inspector, Nicholas Drummond, is on the first flight to New York when he learns his colleague, Elaine York, the minder of the crown jewels for the Jewel of the Lion exhibit at the Met, was found murdered. Then the centerpiece of the exhibit, the famous Koh-i-Noor diamond, goes missing from the Queen Mother's crown. Drummond, American-born but raised in the UK, is a fast-rising star in the Yard who never backs down. This case is no exception. Special agents Lacey Sherlock and Dylan Savage from Coulter's best-selling FBI series don't hesitate to help find the cunning international thief known as the Fox, who will stop at nothing to deliver the Koh-i-Noor to the man who believes in its deadly prophecy. Renee Rodman and McLeod Andrews narrate.
He'd searched for 3 months before he'd finally found the Fox. He would have never guessed the master thief was this woman who looked more like a rich man's mistress than the most successful thief in the world. She was stunning, true, but it was her eyes that knocked a man on his heels. They were a clear, icy blue, the irises rimmed in black, imperceptibly slanted at the corners. And she was looking at him straight on, amused at his surprise, waiting for him to speak. He realized in that moment the fact that she was a woman served his purposes very well indeed. Yes, this was perfect. The skill set the Fox provided was unparalleled, legendary even. The best, he'd heard it from his father and several trusted men of his acquaintance. He wondered dispassionately if, in addition to stealing, she was any good in bed. After they finished their business, would she want to go upstairs to his suite? He supposed he wouldn't mind. But first things first. He watched the waiter fill her flute with champagne. She raised the flute, tipped it toward him for a moment. No smile, only a rather bored assessment in her clear blue eyes. It shocked him. She found him boring? He watched her drink the champagne straight down, never taking her eyes off him. Fully aware, he was watching her every move. She slowly licked her lips. A signal? He still said nothing. Merely signaled to the waiter to pour her another. She drank again, still silent. He knew all the men in the bar were looking at them, wondering what she was to him. How their expressions would change if he announced to the bar who and what she was. He sipped his Macallan, felt the smooth fire of the 64-year-old whiskey slide down his throat. When he'd finally found the fox, they'd corresponded through a coded email account utilizing a simple and elegant system of protection. They both had passwords to the account. Salim would write an email and save it as a draft, and the fox would log in, read the mail in the drafts folder, delete it, then write a response and save it to drafts. They'd been writing for weeks now, the messages short, direct. They'd scheduled this, their first and only meeting, last week, and the account had been dormant since. He'd believed he knew women, knew how they thought, knew how they negotiated to get what they wanted, but never had he gotten the slightest hint the fox was a woman. Amazing. He set his glass on the table. "Are you really the person I seek?" She only nodded again, that slight smile playing around her mouth. She never looked away from him. Salim said slowly, "Very well. Let us begin." She slid a piece of paper across the table. Her hands were slim and elegant, nails short and polished the palest pink. Her forearm slid briefly from the edge of her sleeve with a graceful whisper of fabric, and her delicate wrist turned slightly. He saw generations of her ancestors in the sleek, unconscious movement, like a geisha serving him tea before she robbed him blind and slipped a knife between his ribs. He opened the slip of paper and kept his face still, not reacting to the number she'd written. Never in their emails had they discussed her price. He looked up to see her watching him, her eyes so blue he would swear that if he looked long enough, he would see the azure skies of his homeland. Except he realized in that moment her eyes were blank and empty and devoid of anything but shrewd amusement. A chill moved down his spine. He'd never felt this sort of fear before in his life, of anyone, particularly a woman. He hated it, yet it was there deep inside him, this knowledge of her, and with it was a corrosive fear. Her voice was deep and soft, and he leaned forward automatically when she spoke, though he could hear her clearly above the conversations in the bar.
"You are surprised."
"Yes."
"That is nothing for something so priceless."
That was The Final Cut by Catherine Coulter and J.T. Ellison. The Inspector Gamache novels by Louise Penny are a Book Report favorite. In Book 9, How the Light Gets In, Christmas is fast approaching, and Quebec looks and feels dazzling. But shadows are falling on the usually festive season for Chief Inspector Armand Gamache. Most of his agents have left the homicide department, and his old friend and lieutenant, Jean-Guy Beauvoir, hasn't spoken to him in months. When Gamache receives a message from Myrna Landers that a longtime friend has failed to arrive in the village of Three Pines for Christmas, he welcomes the chance to leave the city. Mystified by Myrna's reluctance to reveal her friend's name, Gamache soon discovers the missing woman was once one of the most famous people in the world and now goes unrecognized by virtually everyone. As events come to a head, Gamache is drawn even deeper into the world of Three Pines. Increasingly, he is not only investigating the disappearance of Myrna's friend, but also seeking a safe place for himself and his still loyal colleagues. Ralph Cosham narrates. We've just heard How the Light Gets In by Louise Penny.
Armand stepped outside into the cold, crisp night. The snow had long since stopped and the sky had cleared. It was just past midnight, and as he stood there, taking deep breaths of the clean air, the lights on the trees went out. The chief inspector and Henri were the lone creatures in a dark world. He looked up, and slowly the stars appeared. Orion's Belt, the Big Dipper, the North Star, and millions of other lights, all very, very clear now, and only now, the light only visible in the dark. Gamache found himself uncertain what to do and where to go. He could return to Montréal, though he was tired and would rather not, but he hadn't made any arrangements to stay at the B&B, preferring to go straight to Myrna. And now it was past midnight, and all the lights were out at the B&B. He could only just make out the outline of the former Coach Inn against the forest beyond. But as he watched, a light, softened by curtains, appeared at an upstairs window. And then, a few moments later, another downstairs. Then he saw a light through the window in the front door, just before it opened. A large man stood silhouetted on the threshold. "Come here, boy, come here," the voice called, and Henri tugged at the leash. Gamache dropped it, and the shepherd took off along the path, up the stairs and into Gabri's arms. When Gamache arrived, Gabri struggled to his feet. "Good boy," he embraced the chief inspector. "Get inside. I'm freezing my ass off. Not that it couldn't use it."
"How do you know we were here?"
"Myrna called. She thought you might need a room." He regarded his unexpected guest. "You do want to stay, don't you?"
"Very much," said the chief, and had rarely meant anything more.
Gabri closed the door behind them. Jean-Guy Beauvoir sat in his car and stared at the closed door. He was slumped down, not so far as to disappear completely, but far enough to make it look like he was trying to be discreet. It was calculated and, somewhere below the haze, he knew it was also pathetic. But he didn't care any more. He just wanted Annie to look out her window, to recognize his car, to see him there, to open the door. He wanted to feel her in his arms again, to smell her scent. He wanted her to whisper, "It'll be all right." Most of all, he wanted to believe it. "Myrna told us that Constance was missing," said Gabri, reaching for a hanger for Gamache's coat. He took the parka from the chief and paused. "Are you here about her?"
"I'm afraid so."
Gabri hesitated just an instant before asking, "She's dead?" The chief nodded. Gabri hugged the parka and stared at Gamache. While he longed to ask more questions, he didn't. He could see the chief's exhaustion. Instead, he finished hanging up the coat and walked to the stairs. Gamache followed the immense, swaying dressing gown up the stairs. Gabri led them along the passage and stopped at a familiar door. He flicked a switch to reveal the room Gamache always stayed in. Unlike Gabri, this room, indeed the entire bed and breakfast, was a model of restraint. Oriental throw rugs were scattered on the wide plank floor. The dark wood bed was large and inviting, and made up with crisp white linens, a thick white duvet, and down pillows. It was uncluttered and comforting, simple and welcoming. "Have you had dinner?"
"No, but I'll be fine until morning."
The clock on the bedside table said 12:30. Gabri crossed to the window, opened it a sliver to let the fresh, cold air in, and pulled the curtains closed. "At what time would you like to get up?"
6:30 too early?"
Gabri blanched. "Oh, not at all. We're always up at that hour." At the door he paused. "You do mean 6:30 p.m., right?" Gamache placed his satchel on the floor by the bed.
"Merci, patron,"
he said with a smile, holding Gabri's eyes for a moment.
We've just heard How the Light Gets In by Louise Penny. Caterer and sleuth extraordinaire Goldie Schultz jumps from the frying pan into the fire in The Whole Enchilada, Book 17 in Diane Mott Davidson's delectable series. Once again, Barbara Rosenblatt performs the book, and as we know, many audiobook listeners, myself included, will seek out any title she performs. In this one, Goldie knows her food is to die for, but she never expects one of her best friends to keel over after a birthday party she's catered. At first, everyone assumes all the fun of the party did her in. But what looks like a coronary turns out to be a serving of cold-blooded murder. And the clever culprit is just getting cooking.
when a colleague who resembles Goldie is stabbed and Goldie is attacked outside of her own house, it becomes clear the caterer is the main course on a killer's menu.
Alas, if only it had been that easy. Within 45 minutes, I was ready to scream. Granted, I had physical aches, but waves of psychic pain, the memories of Holly, the regrets, the new information from Tom. We're treating this as a homicide. We have to consider the possibility that Drew poisoned or otherwise harmed his own mother, threatened to engulf me. These were heavier, more tangible somehow than my sore leg and throbbing head. They made me feel vulnerable. Any little thing, Tom's absence while he dealt with the cashier, Julian's disappearance to pick up my prescriptions, Arch locating Tom's car and bringing it to the exit, then rushing off to get his Passat, threatened to put me over the edge. Sitting in the insisted-upon wheelchair by the exit, I stewed and considered hollering about the injustice of it all. One thing Tom had given me was my cell, which the nurse's aide said I could use. I checked my voicemail messages. 3. All from Marla. "How are you?" said her disembodied voice. "I feel like hell. I need you to tell me it was all a bad dream." The second, "Goldie, where are you? Pick up your phone." The third, "Okay, now I'm both worried and pissed, and I'm going to stay up until you call. And it doesn't matter if it's in the wee hours. Patsy Boatfield stayed and helped bring stuff in from outside. She never really knew Holly." The message cut off. I checked the time on my cell. Just after 1 a.m. My watch had magically disappeared. Even while reluctantly conceding that removing a patient's watch might be hospital policy, or that my discount store timepiece might not be working so well anymore, now that it had spent some time, don't start screaming, I told myself, underwater, I punched in Marla's number. "Where the hell have you been?" she demanded, before the phone had even rung one full time. I gave her an abbreviated version of falling into the lake. Since Tom was ultra-scrupulous about people listening, precisely because folks did gossip, and since the nurse's aide was still at my side, I omitted any mention of being at Holly's rental, or the note that had sent me into the water. I just said I fell off a deck into Aspen Meadow Lake. I tried to put warning in my voice, and she caught it. "You're somewhere you can't talk." "Yep. Call me when you're alone. I'm making slow progress with these dishes," she moaned. The fencing parents all wanted to pitch in, but I said, no, just wrap up any leftovers you want and take your kids home. My cleaning lady will be here in the morning, and of course I forgot that the cleaning lady took off the entire month of June. Patsy was great, though. "Wait," I said. Tom was approaching from the end of the hallway. I bade Marla a hasty farewell with the promise, cross my heart and hope to die, that I would call her as soon as I was free of the hospital. Which, unfortunately, I forgot to do because Tom signaled for me to go with him. Arch and Julian were following in the Passat. I wanted to hear what Tom had in mind, although if it contained the news that they were indicting Drew for the murder of his mother, maybe I didn't. "Tell me what you're thinking about Drew," I demanded, as soon as we pulled away from the curb. Tom's tone turned wary. "I sent another deputy over to question him in foster care." I made an exasperated sigh. Tom flicked me a glance that I could just make out from the streetlights. "This deputy's been an investigator for a while. He said Drew was very upset. He also said we shouldn't rule him out yet." It felt as if my throat was closing. I croaked. "Did he give a reason?" "Said it was just a gut feeling. He couldn't ask Drew specifics about poisons or anything like that, because we don't know what we're dealing with."
That was The Whole Enchilada by Diane Mott Davidson. Read readers, Tom Clancy will be missed, but we are fortunate indeed to have such a wide selection of established authors and newcomers to carry the torch in this popular genre. For suggestions on what to read next, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.